Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Shubhadeep Mandal, and I am a research assistant with ICS New Delhi. On behalf of ICS, I welcome you all to the ICS Wednesday seminar. Speaker for today's seminar is Professor S. Chandrasekhar. He will be focusing on the topic space capabilities and China's military strategy. To make the China dream a reality and to achieve the great rejuvenation, China has been plunging on advanced weaponry and equipments. China's military prowess has increased rapidly in the past 2 decades, and its pursuit of sophisticated weaponry has initiated advancement of its space program as well. The seminar will focus on China's space capabilities in the broader context of China's growing military might and also explore the challenges faced by China in development of the space program. Chairing the session this afternoon is Lieutenant General J.S. Bajwa, the former Chief of Staff, Eastern Command. He superannuated after over 39 years of service in the Army, having operated in diverse active personnel and counter-terrorism environments. He has been conferred with the award of Param Vishesh Seva Medal, PVSM, Uttam Youth Seva Medal, UYSM, and Seva Medal SM. For distinguished service. He has authored 3 books on China's PLA. Currently, he is the editor of the prestigious quarterly magazine, Indian Defense Review. Before I hand over to the chair, I will request all participants to follow the housekeeping rules. The participants have remained muted during the presentation. Questions can be posed in the chat box during the session, or you can use the raise hand option during the Q&A. Please mute yourself only when asked upon by the chair. I will now hand over the floor to Lieutenant General Bajwa to take upon the proceedings forward. Sir, the floor is you.
Thank you. Namaskar. And on behalf of ICS, I welcome all those who have joined the webinar this afternoon. And very warm greetings on a very cold afternoon from here. Today, we have Mr. Chandrasekhar telling us about a bit from his book, China's Space Program, from the era of Mao Zedong to Xi Jinping. Now, Mr. Chandrasekhar is with the JRD, a visiting professor at the National Institute of Advanced Studies. And prior to joining the institute, he was a professor in the corporate strategy and policy areas in IIM Bangalore. And prior to that, he worked with the Indian Space Research Organization for 20 years. At ISRO, his work covered all aspects of and programs of satellites, rockets, as well as application of space technology, especially remote sensing. He was also involved in activities related to international cooperation and has represented and led Indian delegations to the United Nations Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. His current work at the Institute covers missiles, nuclear weapons, and space domains. These include war and deterrence strategies, space weapons, and space wars, with special focus on China. His recent works takes a look at what India should do in space as a response to global changes in the world order that increasingly links space assets with conventional and nuclear wars. His expertise and experience seem phenomenal. A bit about this book that covers the history and current developments and the Chinese space program. We'd be very much interested in the contemporary aspects of the Chinese space program. You know, there may not be much interest in the US space program for an average Indian as there is in the Chinese space program. Most Indians see China as a peer competitor, but we will wait to see what the author has to say about that. Post Mao and his cultural revolution and the purge of the non-peasants, China has made a remarkable recovery and to forge ahead in science and technology. And China views exploration of outer space as part of the national development. However, there are many questions that arise. Is space an endless domain that can accommodate even latecomers? Why is there a race in space to be there first? Is it just prestige? Like territorial boundaries on land, territorial seas, contiguous seas, and EEZ in the oceans, will there be exclusive space zones? Who will frame the rules for exploiting space domain and for space governance? Is it likely that the early entrants will dictate some form of resource nationalism and exclusive rights? Dual use technology, civil military fusion, and intellectual property rights are aspects which cannot be ignored. And what will be a space war be like? Is China trying to secure the space high ground for espionage and nuclear deterrence? These are very interesting issues that one would like to know. The white paper on China's space activities in 2016 lists and aims of their program. There are serious issues and need to be extensively debated. And I'm sure Mr. Chandrasekhar will cover these. After the author's discourse, the webinar is open to the participants for questions. And without further ado, I will now request Mr. Chandrasekhar to present his case, 40 minutes and maybe 45, and even we'll give him a little extra 50 are allotted to him. Please go ahead, Mr. Chandrasekhar.
I would like to thank General Bajwa for his very kind remarks, and I will try and get my presentation organized. Let me just try that. Okay. Can you see it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, now can you see the whole screen?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay.
It's not from the first slide.
That's okay. I think the earlier slide is only an introduction slide.
Okay, sir.
Right, I think. Yeah, this is fine. You can start here. Okay. So the first thing I want to say is that we saw two major events in 2022. One was, of course, the Russian and Ukrainian confrontation in Eastern Europe. And when we were trying to come to grips with what was going on there, we had another major event that happened. And this time it was in the Taiwan Straits. Okay. And between August 4th and August 7th, the People's Republic of China actually carried out a very threatening and extensive military exercise across the straits over Taiwan. And in that exercise, it kind of flexed a lot of its muscle, okay? It launched a number of missiles and it carried out a number of these amphibious landing exercises in order to kind of pass a message on both to Taiwan and to the United States, saying that if you do too many things in Taiwan, I think it was triggered by the visit of Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan, and they just wanted to show that they were no longer in a position where they could take anything that the US wanted to do to them, and that they were capable of responding in kind in case the US decided to actively involve in Taiwan. So it was a kind of muscular response to a very ordinary, not so important visit, maybe one could argue, But the Chinese used this visit as an excuse to tell off both the Americans and its allies in the Pacific, as well as Taiwan, that they are in a position to take on, if required, the US if it chooses to intervene actively in what China perceives to be its own territory. Okay, so this is really what happened. But the crisis that we saw is actually not a very different crisis from several other crises that had happened in the past. The 1995-96 crisis also occurred across the states. And at that time, China was not really in such a strong position as it is today. At that time, they confined themselves to a very limited part of the shores of China. And as you can see from the slide, it was a very limited, they only tried to look at two of the very near islands to China's eastern shoreline. And they didn't really address everything around Taiwan. Whereas this time around, they've chosen to not only launch missiles all around, but all the exercises are targeted at critical nodal points in the Taiwanese military architecture. So this is a significant improvement from what they were able to do in 1995-96. But 1995-96 itself was the third of the crisis. Before that, during the Korean War also, the US, using its naval power, was able to threaten the PRC. And there was another crisis in the beginning of the early part of Mao's regime, which was the first Taiwan crisis, 1954. And then there was another crisis in 1958. And every time what the US did was to send a couple of aircraft carriers into the seas around China's eastern shoreline. And the Chinese had to accept the reality that they were nowhere near confronting the US, such a big power. And in spite of all the rhetoric, they knew that the reality of power was the reality of power, and they decided not to push it. But that is not the situation today. As you can see, they have launched a number of missiles targeting all parts around Taiwan. They've also carried out a number of amphibious landing exercises, which tell that we can actually do everything that it takes if we need to occupy Taiwan. And of course, they also fired a number of missiles that landed in the EEZ of Japan. So it also tells the US and its allies that we are prepared to take you on in case you want to get into a Taiwan problem. So obviously, Taiwan is a major area of concern for China. But is that the only area? No. China has many, many vulnerabilities. And therefore, in order to fix the Taiwan crisis in a kind of ranking scheme, we may also need to look at what are China's other vulnerabilities, and is there a logical way in which we can address some of them and identify its priorities in terms of what it wants to do, in terms of not only the military deployment of its forces, but also in terms of its longer term strategy that it wants to pursue. So if you look at the map carefully, China has borders with 14 countries. Okay, I think it is possibly the country with the largest number of borders in the world. Okay, and so that all these 14 boundaries are likely to be potential sources of concern for China. Obviously, some are more important than others. Maybe some are not important at all, and maybe everything is okay. And therefore, in order to understand the kind of land-based problems that China may have, we need to be able to convert not only China's neighbors, but China's neighbors' neighbors into a kind of framework within which we can look at all of them and then try to come up with an integrated way in which we can address the vulnerabilities that China may currently look at. So we have what is called a network representation of these relationships, the border relationships. And what you see on this slide is a relationship of the is a network relationship of these of these land problems. And as you can see from this, that in spite of the fact that there are many borders, the ones that seem to be of major concern, right, revolve around a few geographies. Obviously, one major concern that China has had in the past, as well as it's likely to have in the future, is the Korean Peninsula. Everybody knows North Korea, South Korea. the support that China extends to North Korea, which is a buffer between it and the and South Korea. And historically, it's had a lot to do with the Korean War, for example, why it was fought. So obviously, one concern that the Chinese have is the Korean Peninsula. Indochina, you know that China fought a war with Vietnam. The Vietnamese war itself involved China in many ways. So Vietnam is another concern which China has. So the Indochina Peninsula, especially Vietnam, is the second area of concern. And obviously the Indian border, which has become recently hyperactive in a sense, with China always needling India to show that it is vulnerable, is a third kind of thing. So these are obviously three of the more important land. Okay. And if you look at the other parts of it, for example, you look at the Burma side of it, or the Pakistan, Afghanistan, they're all matters of concern, even Central Asia to some extent, but maybe not to the same extent. So you can argue that these three appear to be high on the vulnerability side, especially from the land part of the vulnerabilities of China. And let's not forget that if you look at the geography of China, I think Xinjiang and Tibet account for about 2/3 of the area. So the core of China is really the part that is concentrated around the coastline, okay? So I have a different study which looks at all that. I don't want to get into those details, but you can also look at the internal geography of China and look at how it has been together for how long and come up with some measure of its internal vulnerabilities. I'm not going to talk too much about that. So this is just a representation of how we can look at the vulnerabilities from the land side. But again, if you go back and look at the history of China over the last, 200 years, most of China's problems, especially over the last 200 years, have not come from the land, okay? They have largely come from the sea. The Chinese talk about 100 years of humiliation, okay? The 100 years is largely the maritime power of the Western countries and how they have used that power in order to exploit China. I mean, it is definitely, if you go back and look at history, it is a major exploitation of the West of China. And of course, China was too weak to do anything about it. And obviously that exercise is never going to be repeated if we go by the writings and the speeches and the way China is going about conducting itself in the modern world. So it is seeing itself as a major counter to anybody else, and it definitely wants to be this regional power. There's no doubt about that aspect of it. But because of the fact that the sea has also been a major source of vulnerability, to identify the total sequence, or shall we say the priorities in terms of vulnerabilities, we need to look at the maritime domain also. So here we have a representation of the maritime domain. And here, if you look carefully at it, Taiwan obviously, right, has been a major concern. Although Taiwan has been a part of mainland China only for about 400 years or 500 years, unlike the core part of China, which has been together for more like 1,200 years. And it has been occupied by the Japanese, especially in the period between the two world wars. And therefore, it is something which is, and there is a strong case for, after the Long March and the win and the PRC coming into force, all the Chinese national, all the forces moved to Taiwan. Okay, all the other side, Chiang Kai-shek's forces moved to Taiwan. And that was the reason why actually there's a significant Chinese presence even now in Taiwan. But Taiwan therefore remains at the heart of what China will look upon its legitimate sovereign interest. Okay, so obviously Taiwan is very important. Korean Peninsula, which we also identified on the long land side, is important. The Vietnam and Indochina is another important thing. And let's not forget, South Korea is an irritant. The Philippines have traditionally been very close to the US. Japan is a US ally, especially after the World War. And therefore you have a whole string of countries which are very much along the Western side of the power equations, okay? And therefore these are all matters of concern, and a lot of them is actually going to come through the sea, okay? And let's not forget the US has a huge, big air base in Guam. And therefore a US territory is also a matter of concern for China. So there's also a direct relationship. And the ASEAN country is largely neutral, but one would argue when push comes to shove, one doesn't know which way they will go. But obviously they'd like the relationship, the economic relationship with China. However, they may be siding more with the Western bloc in terms of the political affiliation that they want. And therefore, China needs to make sure that it has enough muscle in order to deal with that. So if you look at this entire spectrum of analysis, a lot of it is therefore tilted in favor of the Western countries. And therefore, China is relatively not so well connected or well allied in terms of, and therefore it has to be strong. Okay. And therefore, this requirement, therefore, will enable us to get a fix on the kind of priorities that we think that they should have in mind. Okay. So obviously, Taiwan emerges, as we had seen in the Taiwan crisis, the beginning of this talk, is number one on the list of the Chinese priorities. The US base at Guam is obviously very important because a lot of worry that they have might come from there. Japan and a close ally of the US bases in Japan, all of these have been matters of concern over a long period of time. Korean Peninsula, again, South Korea is, and the North Korean problems, good and bad, both for China and the world. And Indochina, of course, Vietnam is certainly no longer a friend of China, as it seemed to be during the Cold War period. So obviously, these are some of the major, and all of them have a significant sea component. And therefore, China has to worry about being able to deal with threats along the sea coast. That would be a major challenge. While land has to be protected, and it will be protected, the sea emerges more likely as the major reason why China, because the core of China is on the eastern, off the eastern shoreline of it. And therefore, to protect it, it generates most of its GDP. It is possibly the largest number of cities, a large number of people. Most of them are Han Chinese. So all these other factors are also there, which make it the kind of core that you want to defend. And therefore, this part is how we want to look at why is China doing all these things, how to protect it. And I'm sure all of you are very familiar. So China has this notion of what is called the first island chain. And then it has this notion of a second island chain. Ideally, it wants to dominate the parts of the sea inside the first island chain. And in the second part, along the second island chain, it wants to make sure, right, that it is still significant. It can be contested, but the Chinese should have a significant military edge if there is any kind of war. And therefore, these notions of the first island chain and second island chain, largely to protect itself against these Western countries and the allies of the Western countries for, the possible problems that come along the sea route. Okay, and that is really the part. Now, ideally, what would China want to do? Apart from protecting this and apart from making sure that it is able to contend with any kind of war within these two island chains, it also wants to make sure that can it deter and can it prevent the entry of any foreign military asset into these waters. So obviously it has to look beyond the first and the second island chain in order to find out what is coming. Then it has to be able to deal with what is coming. It has to identify them, it has to deal with them, it has to be able to target them and do something about them. So this is the notion of what is called, you need the over the horizon kind of capability. And therefore, you want to go over the horizon and you want that kind of capability. One of the key requirements to get that capability is what is called a space capability. So if you put a sensor on a satellite, it will be, and it goes in orbit, you will be able to cover all parts of the world, okay? And you'll be able to definitely have coverage over the immediate region of access into the eastern shoreline of China. So this notion of anti-access, you don't want people coming in, you want to know who they are and you want to prevent them or threaten them from coming inside. And area denial, you want to make sure that the area of access is denied, okay? So these are the two elements of what the Western countries call anti-access area denial strategy the Chinese are providing. In order to be able to do that, you need to go over the horizon and you need to be able to make observations and also deal with objects at those distances. So obviously you need either aircraft or drones or missiles. You also need ships, you also need submarines, you may need all of this. So all of that is ancillary, but fundamentally you want to make sure that you are able to do these operations well before anything comes within the second language. Okay. So if you look at it, one of the critical requirements that China needs at all costs is a space capability and a significant what is called intelligence surveillance and reconnaissance capability, simplified to ISR. So what are the Chinese doing about this? Now, if you look at the program of China over the last 10, 15 years, they have these series of satellites called Yaogang satellites. All of them are military satellites. They have launched about 68 of them by 2020. I'm sure they've launched some more in 21 and 22. I've stopped looking at it at 2020, so we can do this again. Now, as of now, 40 of them are operational. And they are dedicated for the what I call the intelligence surveillance and reconnaissance function. They consist of several kinds of satellites. There are what is called these electronic intelligence satellites. Now, what do they do? A military platform like a ship or an aircraft carrier is constantly communicating, constantly sending out commands and getting messages across. It is always radiating some electromagnetic signal or the other. Using the signal, can we identify what it is? This is, goes back a long time. It's possible to do that. And one possible platform where you can cover a large area for this identification is to put such a sensor on the satellite. And if you can sense the emissions that are coming from these ships, you are in a good position to know what that ship is, and you can then track it in using other ways. So that's one kind of a thing that you need. Obviously, if you have a camera, a satellite carrying a camera, and it's taking a picture of a ship or an aircraft carrier, you know exactly where it is. You know what it is. You can identify it without any effect, right? And then you have what's called a synthetic aperture radar, which is just another way of taking a picture. Maybe it's not really a picture, but something like a picture. And what's the advantage of a synthetic aperture radar? It doesn't have to worry whether there's a cloud cover over the area of interest or not. It can take a picture through cloud cover. It can take a picture during the night also. So it cover gives you 24-hour coverage. So you put this constellation of satellites together, in principle, you should be able to figure out, right, where an object, what an object is, where is it located, where is it moving, and should I worry about it or not? All these things are not possible. So what we did in YAS, which is what I will try to focus on as something that we did something different maybe, is to look at the coverage of Taiwan during the August 4th to August 7th crisis. So we selected from these 40 satellites, the typical LN satellites and the electro-optical satellites and the SAR satellites, and we looked at how often or how much did they cover Taiwan during the crisis. Okay, I want to talk about those results. But before I talk about those results, I wanted to give you a little bit of a picture of how these coverages, what these sensors do. Okay, so just bear with me for this, because you need to understand a little bit about what they do. Now, the first one is, it's not enough to know an emission source, right? You also need to locate it, okay? So you need to locate it in the vast reaches of the Pacific Ocean, which is the access route, you know, to the shoreline of China, right? And how do you do that, okay? Now, China has in place what is called a broad, a broad coverage, right, LNT satellite, okay? Now, what does it consist of? A typical Yaogang 31 series, which is one kind of an LNT satellite that China has, is not made up of one satellite. It is made up of three satellites, okay? The three satellites fly in a triangular formation, okay? And all the three satellites receive the same emission from the ground. The aircraft carrier is sending a message to a pilot, a helicopter pilot or something like that. It picks up that message or it picks up that signal. And all three of them pick up that same signal. Now, using simple triangulation, you can then fix with reasonable level of accuracy the position of the emitter on the ground. Okay? So this concept was deployed or used by the Americans in the 70s. The Chinese are now using it. I'm sure the Americans have now cut down from 3 to 2 satellites, or maybe even a single satellite. Chinese are still using the three triangular formation. So you know the spacing between all the three satellites, and you know the source of emission, and you can locate it, right? And that's simple geometry and little bit of electronics should be able to do that. And obviously you can locate it only with a little bit of a coarse resolution. So typical numbers that we're talking about is within a 7,000 kilometer radius area, which is the coverage of the source satellite, which means any emitter within that circle will be picked up by the satellite. You can locate a particular emitter to about a 25 kilometer error. Okay. So this is one very important. Now these satellites can be easily identified using public domain information. What are the characteristics of them? They're all launched. Three of them are launched together on one rocket. Okay. They all have an inclination of 63.4 degrees. Okay. And after flying, they're obviously going to be very closely. You can actually measure or look at their orbital parameters and figure out that they are flying together. Okay. So all of them are possible. Okay. And using public information, we can do a fair amount of clear identification of these kinds of satellites. We have a methodology we have developed. So this is, goes back to about 10 years or so. All of it is well known in the literature. It is all there. Just question of putting it together. Okay. So this is the first kind of alien satellite that we are talking about. Then the other thing is, it's not enough to know, it's located. You need to be able to track it on a continuing mode. Now, China has in place another kind of alien satellites, another set of alien satellites, but these are not, they are not triplets which fly in a triangular formation. They are placed in one plane. So they are coplanar in one orbital plane, and they are distributed in the orbital plane, right? So that when one satellite goes over the horizon, the second satellite, so a satellite goes over Taiwan, it goes, disappears, followed by another satellite, which is almost in the same orbit. As the Earth rotates, it has to shift a little. So it will then follow it up, then it will follow it up another one. There are six satellites, okay, in one plane. Then the Earth rotates, of course, and after some time, these six satellites will go away. There is another six satellites that will come. So there are three different planes, each of them having six satellites, which will ensure that at all times, there will be at least one satellite over the area of interest. And they're all having an inclination of 35 degrees, which means that they will cover the area between 35 degrees north latitude and 35 degrees south latitude with a very high frequency. Okay, so this is the second group of, so they're all in orbits of about 610 kilometers. They're all inclined 35 degrees. And so this is the other kind of thing. And all of them can be identified again using open source information on a number of parameters, which we can put together, tabulate, and then do some sorting operations to figure out what they are. So this is the second kind of thing that they have. Now, just to give you an idea, the six satellites which I talked about, the tactical constellation, they are distributed in the orbit like this. Okay, so as one goes over, the other one will take over, right? So this is the Earth, and then you have six of them spread out at 60 degrees interval, so that it is continuously, so Taiwan, for example, will be continuously covered. Okay, so that's the idea of this kind of constellation. So just to give an idea, so one plane, two planes, each of these planes are separated by 120 degrees. So as the Earth rotates, one plane goes away, the second plane comes. As the Earth rotates again, the third plane comes, okay? And let's not forget, as the satellites go up, they can pick up the signals. As they come down, they can pick up the signals. So you have to take all these into account when we look at the coverage, okay? So these 18 satellites, and there were 12 of the broad area coverage position location LN satellites together, right, will enable China to pick up a emitting source anywhere in the Pacific Ocean, and it will be able to keep tabs on it as it comes into the second or the first island. Okay, so that is the logic of this constellation. Now, in order to complement this, they also have, right, regular cameras, right? You can think of them as cameras, picture taking, optical picture taking. One of them is in higher altitude orbits, which has a larger coverage. And the other one is at a slightly lower altitude with a smaller coverage. Now, these cameras can swing across the track, which means that they can, you don't have to look at it vertically down. You can move it to one side and you can move it to the other side. So typically for the lower altitude 600 kilometer satellite, you can swing it 600 kilometers on either side. For the higher altitude, you can swing it 1,000 kilometers. And within that, you can image something of I think 100 kilometers and 60 kilometers. Okay, so that's the kind of numbers that we can get, which will also enable. So if you take a picture of an aircraft carrier, you know the exact position of the satellite. The picture is very accurate. You can measure the position of the aircraft carrier to the order of meters. So when you're looking at 25 kilometers, if you go through the ELINT tactical constellation from 25, it will continue to track it. Maybe the error will build up. The moment you have one of these, the error will come back, right? And then obviously it will again propagate till you have another visibility. So this is the kind of logic. So you can use the cues from the broad area ELINT coverage, right? And the tactical ELINT to keep tabs. And then with these, the positions can be fixed even more firmly. And then it will go back, again, drift over some time. And again, then going back the position together. So you can see how this constellation can work. And of course, you have also what is called a SAR. Now the SAR has this characteristic that it will not image the part that is directly underneath. It will only look at the side of the path. That the orbital trace is going in one direction, it will only look at the side part of it. So that also can swing it a little bit on either side. So it covers about 1,000 kilometers with about 100 kilometers worth. So these are the things that, so I just wanted to get a visual idea of how this coverage is done. Okay. So it's a large number of satellites. You need to keep tabs on all of them. You need to be able to queue all of them. And you need a transfer of information as and when they are picked up, quick processing. And you need a control room where all of this comes together. And then you must be able to orchestrate the coverage in such a way that you can keep continuous tags on the objects of interest. So this is roughly the kind of thing that the Chinese have put in place. Now, what have we done to add to this? This is all stuff that we have done earlier, and we have talked about it quite a bit. But what we have done recently is to kind of give it a little bit more teeth. I have a colleague of mine called Dr. Ramani, who used to work in ISRO with me, a very gifted software programmer. So he and I got together and we came up with this package called Vini Vidi Vici. Okay. I came, I saw, I contoured. That's the kind of package we have. So what it does is, so you know that these satellites are there, you can identify these satellites, but you would like to look at the propagation of the satellite orbits. In order to do that, we use the NORAD two-line elements, NORAD, the North American Air Defense Command puts out these orbital details of all the satellites. And you can get those orbital details from them, right? If you have those orbital details, which they send, you can then propagate the orbit. You can convert it into an orbit propagation model, and we can look at how the satellites are going around the Earth. Now, once you know what kind of a satellite is there, and you know what kind of sensor is this, on that orbit propagation model, we can also build a model of the sensor. So once we identify the satellite and we know its propagation, we can also model the sensor and put it onto the package, which is what we've done. So we can model a camera, we can model an ELINT package, we can model a SAR, and we can feed in those parameters to this thing, and it will then, so then we can look at the coverage, okay? Now what this package does in addition is you can specify a particular point or a particular area in the Earth. And we will be able to tell you how many times the particular satellite or a combination or a constellation of satellites cover the data. So this is a package that we have done. Okay. So we have taken this package and looked at typically 30 of the Yaogang satellites. 12 of them are the broad area ELINT satellites. I have all the numbers listed in the details. Okay, and the tactical 18 ELINT satellites. We have not yet taken into account the optical and the SAR. The next exercise we will do all that, but I'll tell you how we can act. So this is the basic thing that we have used in order to look at what the Chinese can do. So let me give you an idea. So the results after we did this Taiwan coverage between August 4th. So we took the period on August 4th to August 5th, the first part of the period. And let me tell you roughly how we do this. The first, so we start at a particular time, I think 12 midnight or something on the 4th we started, okay. And after 3 minutes have elapsed, okay, Yaogang 30Z has seen Taiwan for 2 minutes, okay. So out of the total time of 3 minutes, 2 minutes Taiwan is covered, And we have what's called this dynamic efficiency, which is basically 2 divided by 3. The rounding of the numbers, because these are all in milliseconds and microseconds and all that. So, you know, so that's why it is 66.45 not in that. Okay. So now you can see that immediately after that, you have another satellite, 30AA, right? The elapsed time is 4 minutes, but the total coverage time for both of them together is 3 minutes, okay? So you can see that 3 divided by 4 is approximately 75%. So you can see that you can see the coverage time as it progresses, and you can look at the elapsed time as it progresses, and we can build up this efficiency. In other words, Taiwan is covered for so much during that particular period, okay? So that's the kind of table that we have built up. You can also do a lot more other things, like, you know, can look at the gaps to find out whether there are very long gaps or short gaps. I think most of the simulation exercises we have done showed that the gaps are all order of a few minutes. Okay. So it means that you effectively you have a very, so let me come back. So if you go back and look at it, you can see that very soon, within a couple of hours or 2 or 3 hours, the efficiency goes to about 89%. Okay. In other words, 89% of the time, the area around Taiwan, right, is completely surveyed by these alien satellites, okay? And we can propagate this orbit a little bit more. And you can see that after a day and a little bit more than a day, the coverage efficiency is about 89%, okay? So what this means is just the alien capability that China has is able to make sure that it covers the entire access route to Taiwan, about 89% through its electronic satellite. Now, if you add the imaging satellites to this, right, and you look at the accuracy with which the imaging satellites can improve the location, one would argue that it is almost impossible to evade surveillance, right, in accessing Taiwan. So this is, I think, the significant ISR capability that China has in place. So how does it work? So you start with a large area element, right? It can locate it coarsely. Then you keep tabs on it through the tactical element, lower altitude. They don't know how to locate the position, but they know where it is in a particular area. But since you know the position from earlier, you can narrow down that area, right? And then once in a while, you have a SAR pass or an optical imaging pass or some other, and then you can locate it even more precisely. So this can go on. Right. So this kind of sequencing where the large area ELINT queues the tactical ELINT and periodically updates happen with the optical and the SAR, you will be able to make sure that you not only know what the object is, you're also able to track it as it comes through to the second, into the second island on the first island. Okay. So this is one point. So obviously the collected image has to be moved. And obviously, if you want to move this, the images collected from all over the world, you need satellite capability in order to be able to link, right? So the obvious requirement for this is communication satellites in geostationary orbit. Maybe some of them could also be in other Earth orbits, depending on, middle or even like Elon Musk, maybe lower orbits, right? And therefore, you need a lot of communication satellite capability in order to be able to do that. You also need what's called tracking and data relay satellites, which the Americans pioneered with the Chinese also got. So that together, put them all together, you have what is called C4 ISR capability. Okay, so that's one very important requirement for a modern military information wars that we are fighting today. And how is China placed? I have a detailed assessment in the book. So you can take a look at all of that. I just want to provide you a glimpse of what has covered. Up to 2020, China had launched a total of 678 satellites, starting from its 1970 onwards. Okay. In 2021, it launched 112. In 2022, it launched 182. So the number of satellite launches, including military launches, is likely to be significant. Okay. It's growing up, it's growing exponentially. I'll show you a curve later on how that is going. So that's one requirement. They are a very powerful satellite country. Okay. And if you look at the breakup, they cover all the areas. They launch 73 satellites for commercial customers. They have this model where they build a satellite, put it into orbit, make it work, and then deliver it to the customer. This is basically to guard against American sanctions that have go back about 20 years or so. So they found a way to navigate those sanctions. And therefore, they are also a reasonably big player on the commercial side. Of course, the value proposition is very high because they offer good competitive prices. So that's one part that they have. They have everything else in terms of that. The Argonne satellites are all military. They have a lot of, I'll talk a little bit more about the navigation, of course, is a major military requirement. And they have a navigation system that is comparable with GPS. Remote sensing, they have a large number, not only of commercial operations, a large number of them are also used for military purposes. So the reconnaissance thing that I talked about can be improved significantly or maybe marginally. As you said, it's almost complete. Even that can be improved even better with some of the civilian satellites. The book addresses all of this in detail. You can take a look at it to give you some detail. Okay, so this is the part that has to do with it. So these are just
5 minutes.
Huh? Yeah. I will try to run. So launches, they have very large number of, they had 56 launches, more than the Americans in 2021, 64 launches in 2022. The Americans beat the Chinese, they had 78 launches. Elon Musk alone had 61 launches. So Elon Musk is significantly changing the American response. And as I will show you right at the end, the Americans are now not only catching up, maybe doing even better than the Chinese in terms of what they're doing. So there's a race between these two countries. Okay, clearly that is the message I would put. About 300 satellites are military satellites. That's about 50% of all the satellites that China has built and launched for itself are military satellites, significant number. It covers ASAT, it covers BMD, right? All of that is. So they have all these early warning satellites in geostationary orbit. They have shown all these ASAT maneuvers requirement. They're doing also a lot of work related to ground-based ASAT and all that. So they are doing everything that the Americans are doing. The Americans are still ahead, maybe by a generation. So, but the only power that can even remotely compete with them in terms of what can be done is China. And just to look at the total numbers, so if you plot the cumulative number of satellites, I think by the year 2040, you're looking at a number like maybe about 2,000 satellites, Chinese satellites, okay? And the curve fits very well with the 21 data and the 22 data. So this kind of curve, it's kind of growing exponentially. And therefore, the Chinese capability to do things in space in response to what everybody else is doing is also very significant. So in other words, just to give you the space part correct, it has everything that you need in order to look at the role of space in waging and winning an information war, a local war, information war, under conditions of informationization, as the Chinese call it. I mean, it has everything in place in order to do that, including, as I will point out, it has also the organizational capabilities in order to be able to do that. It's not only about the technical part, it's also done a lot of work on the organizational side to make sure that this integration happens and it's able to structure all these components to provide a focused approach to the problem it needs to address. Of course, they are very good in the missile area. They have a lot of the missiles originally were nuclear. The movement is away from nuclear. A lot of conventional missiles have been added. These are not only missiles that are directed at aircraft carriers, the DF-21, or they call it the DF-26 now, right? All of them. So they have precision strike capability. The Taiwan crisis I talked about in the beginning, a lot of that is pretty precision strike missiles. So that is one part they have. The same missiles can be modified for a BMD function, ballistic missile defense function, they have that. And they can also use it for ASAT, as we saw in the 2007 test. All of you know about it. I'm not going to talk too much about it. So in other words, the missile arsenal, not only for fighting the war of today on the ground and the sea, also to look at the satellite part, to take out the critical satellite nodes in a future war, to defend against ballistic missile attacks. All of it is there. So they have all of it, and a lot of it, these things are all covered also in detail in the book. And of course, they have in place a new organization structure. So they have created what is called a strategic support force, which combines space, cyber, and the electronic warfare, the information part of war. And the other thing they have done is to reorganize their verticals in army, navy, you know, rocket force, etc. They are now organized into theaters. The theaters have the authority to decide on the course of action. And the army, navy, you know, rocket force, air force, all of them provide the requirements in order to look at that war. So the integration is done through theaters. So theaters take are the final authority to decide on how a war in one of the regions of China will be fought. And of course, you all know that it's organized into theater commands. I'm not going to go into it. I think many of you know a lot more about it than I do. And obviously, the central part of China, not the western part, is really the heart of China. And that, if you look at the deployment of resources, seems to be more concentrated in this part. The western part, which is the one that India has to worry about, is relatively not so well endowed. Although I think it's still significant. It's compared to this, these are gotten more of the allocations of resources. I have another report which looks at that. I don't want to go into too much detail about this. Okay, now if you look at the relative power standings in the world, okay, I'd like to take a couple of minutes on this because this is kind of important to look at the strategic side. This was done in the middle of 2021. Okay, you can see that the total number of operating satellites in the world was 4084. The Americans had 2,505. I think Elon Musk alone had about 1,600 or 1,700 of them. Okay, so he's a significant player. He's become an even more significant player now. Okay. Now, China had about 431. Okay, if you look at the percentages, 61% is the US, 11% is China. All the others, in a sense, you can argue, not so important. Russia is not as strong as it used to be. Europe is strong, but it's relatively, compared to the other countries, it's not. Collectively, it's still not a bad power. But as you say, if you take France and Germany, and if you take UK, it kind of breaks up a little bit into other things. So you can see clearly, and the military satellites, the operational ones, you see, they are almost on par. Okay, both China and the US are almost on par. And therefore, the US is also very concerned about China's size. And everybody knows that the US has set up a special space force. Okay, it's become a new wing of the armed forces. And it's a kind of response. And if you look at the recent launches of the US, in terms of number of launches, they did 78 as compared to China's 64, and the number of satellites, US is now not only catching up, it's kind of going ahead of China. But let's come back and look at the other part. Elon Musk alone has more satellites than India, China, et cetera, put together. Okay, India, China, Europe put together. So the Americans are clearly worried about space, and they need to make sure they keep their dominance of space, and they want to make sure that in any kind of issue with China, they are still very powerful military space power. So this tells you a little bit about the relative positioning of the different countries. The US is clearly ahead. China is the only close competitor. Russia is okay but declining. Europe collectively is strong, but again not as powerful as China. France, India, Japan, these are the, I would call, the other countries that matter. And obviously, space's role, you can see that the role of space, C4ISR, ASAT, BMD, is crucial, right, for fighting and winning a war today. Okay? And this is what both China see and what the US sees. And this is what I think we should also worry about a little bit more. Cyber and IT are also very important components, and these are new domains. And obviously, nuclear weapons and conventional weapons. China has a very interesting nuclear weapon approach. Its missiles carry both a nuclear warhead or a conventional warhead. And if there is a confrontation, they are telling the US, if you think it is a conventional weapon or a nuclear weapon, you decide. If you decide wrongly, there is a huge risk of escalation. So unlike the US, which clearly separates out its nuclear arsenal from its non-nuclear conventional arsenal, the Chinese are mixing it up. And this ambiguity is supposedly going to raise the risk of potential escalation during a crisis. So their approach to deterrence, a nuclear deterrence or the nuclear part of deterrence, is somewhat more complicated than what the Americans are. Okay, so this is the other part. So space is going to be a very important component of any kind of war in the foreseeable, I don't know, next 20 years, maybe you can talk about that. I don't know what will happen. And coming back, so the Chinese see space power as an important component of their national power. So which encompasses military power, economic power, political power, and increasingly, if you look at their R&D and spending and papers and citations, knowledge power. Through that, they want to build their power. Both hard power and soft power is their ambition, although the power they have shown so far is more hard than soft. And obviously space is going to be an important part of this comprehensive national power that they are talking about. And before I end, I'd just like to talk a little bit about my boss, Professor Dhawan. I worked with him very closely for a long time. His 100th birth anniversary was last year. And unfortunately, I think because of COVID and many people don't know about him, I just thought I would use this opportunity to say a lot of what we did in this role and what we're doing today. We owe this guy a lot of gratitude. He was one of those great, fantastic leaders and a very, patriotic in a very nice sense Indian, who really put the country before everything else. And, a man who really inspired a lot of us and what I do and what I've learned from him is a very small part of what he was. Okay, and he is one of those people. I think he's somebody we should remember more often, and maybe we should do a little bit more to look at what he did and how he did it, even in terms of what we do as a research agenda, right? We've hardly ever addressed him in any proper way. I feel guilty about it, but maybe we'll try to do something now. And lastly, just wanted to show you the book, China's Space Program is out. It's available with Springer. I think there is also, unfortunately, it's priced heavily. Okay. I think now there is a Amazon PDF available, I think for about 750 rupees or something. I don't know the exact number, but it's available. Now, the other one is the book that I wrote. It is available in the open domain. I made sure that it was available in the open domain. It's called Space War and Security, and it's about what India should do. Of course, it's dated at 2015, but it fundamentally still argues the same case that I was making today. We need to focus on what we need to do. What is it that we need as a strategy? How does space fit into it? And what we should do about it? And of course, it says we need to create a vibrant space industry like Elon Musk. We need a number of people in India who can do similar things. That's the kind of thing we need to create. And this book has also been translated in Chinese, so this is just the Chinese version. I thought I was particularly happy to note that, I don't know whether it evoked any great interest in India, but it definitely evoked a lot of interest in China. Okay. I think I am done. Right.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chandrasekhar. So very, very detailed and comprehensive. The House and the participants are allowed to ask questions. A few questions from my side. Now, you talked of the focus on Taiwan. If there is a focus to be shifted, how easy is it or how difficult is it to shift the focus of the satellites to another region or another area? The entire complex.
I think it's very simple. All the areas between 35 degrees north and 35 degrees south, any area, as long as it lies between 35 degrees north and 35 degrees south across the world, will be covered by the satellite constellation.
But
you need to be able to make sure that you are able to receive the information. And for that, you may need geostationary satellites around the world. But using that combination can cover the whole world.
Okay. The next is about the ability of these being jammed or you know, degraded in any form. Who has this ability? Do we have it? Do the Americans have it? And or the Chinese, can they do that to our satellites?
I think all the satellites that transmit or receive data can be jammed. Okay. So jamming is going to be a standard protocol that you will have to assume, right, will happen during a crisis. And therefore, you have to worry about how will you circumvent jamming measures. There are a number of technical solutions to the problem. I don't want to go into detail, but you know, you should ask somebody who knows more about communications and electronics than I do. But I know from my ISRO days that there are some ways in which you can do that. And GPS, for example, also can be, you know, can be done. And forget, you can also do the cyber attacks on processors and satellites. Okay, so it's getting more and more complicated. So all of that is possible. So the point I'm making is you need to do what I call a baseline, which is the standard model I'm talking about. And then on that baseline, we have to look at all these scenarios. How do we cope with them and find ways and paths by means of which we can achieve what we want to achieve? I think they are all doable, but it requires focused
attention. Yeah, you know, I was reading that
a lot of technical inputs. We, you know, we cannot do it politically. We need a lot of good engineers and technical people to be able to do it.
Yes. You know, I was reading that while the Chinese had, carried out a test of an anti-satellite weapon launched from here, yeah, and in January of 2007, yeah, but they have not proceeded beyond that because they find it is not a very viable solution. It is better to do this jamming and, degrading it in other forms rather than destroying the satellite. Is that correct?
So let me come back. As a planner, as a strategy planner or a military planner, you want to look at all possibilities, right? You want to look at all possibilities. So I would argue that there are a number of approaches that you will have. And depending upon the nature of the problem, you will choose to do either, you know, a limited jamming function, maybe over a particular area, or you could do something more. So in other words, you need a certain level at which you want to operate. And I would argue the kinetic kill, if you do a kinetic kill of another country's satellite, it's a declaration of war, right? So you don't want to obviously to go to that. At the same time, you want to tell them that you can do it, right? That is more a message conveying than actually doing it. So I would argue that ideally, a planner or a strategist would like a string of possibilities within which he can, you know, there are a number of gray levels at which you have to operate or gray areas within which you have to operate. And therefore, all these options like ground-based, you know, DASL, for example. Yeah. So all these are possibilities. One doesn't have anything from the open literature about all this. We need a little bit more technical work inside, right? And to be able to, I'm sure people are doing it, but maybe even, outside the government also, we need some independent people also to look at some of these issues. And see whether we can come up with a lot of it is technically okay, but we don't have precise data. Okay. So dazzling is definitely more. I mean,
yes, dazzling is.
But you know, we are depending upon a US report, right, to say that it can be done. I would also like some Indian, right, who's working in one of these establishments to actually do some experiments and tell us something more. I don't know whether they're doing it. I assume they are doing it, right? But we need that kind of input also. So all of what I'm saying is largely from what I knew when I was working in ISRO and a lot of knowledge that you have acquired by looking at everything available and making some, what I call it, I don't know whether they're consistent, making some consistent extrapolation.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned about the US Space Force. Wow. I was reading that the only other country which has a Space Force is China, but neither of them have anything on ground. They've only nominated something like this, but there is no work. I mean, they still don't know what to do with it and how are they going to create such a force.
See, the Space Force is going to do only operations in space. Okay. Now, the US has already got a lot of things working in space. So what I understand from readings recently is that the responsibilities of the Space Force and the responsibilities for the other entities. For example, there's a geospatial agency that looks at imagery. I don't know, I'm sure there are lots of other entities that are looking at different parts of it. So there is an exercise underway by means of which they're trying to look at it and coordinate all these things. But a bulk of the war fighting and the deterrence and all that stuff, including anti-satellites and maybe even some of the conventional ground-based jamming things, I would argue would come under that. I think the Chinese are also doing something similar. But the Chinese don't have a special space force. The space part is integrated with the cyber and the electronic warfare groups.
Okay? Yeah.
So the Americans are the first to create something equivalent like an air force or a missile force, you know, which is... And I would argue that they are going to become a big, I think they already do. They are already ordering a lot of requirements in terms of what they need in space and how to, all the components of what they think, including proximity or fighting. And they're looking at code of conduct, all that proximity operations. I had some informal discussions with a few people I know. All of them want to know what India is thinking about those things. Okay. So yeah, they're thinking ahead.
Thank you. Sandeep, you could, there are four questions I see in the chat box.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you could request them and read them out.
Okay, sir. So first question is from YS Rajan. He mentions that with only 1% share in the operational satellite in the world, what is the strategy of India? Catch up looks very remote. If the answer could be sensitive, you may speak the reply that he mentions.
I have no hesitation in speaking my mind. I think the Indian share, compared to the time when we left ISRO, has become pretty minuscule. Okay, I think a large part of why we have not done this is because we have not involved Indian industry in a significant way in the space program. I feel that if we really have a clear idea, I think we need... I think we'll currently launch about 5 launches a year or 6 launches a year in a good year. We need to go to 50 or 100, right? And we cannot do it only with ISRO or even with DRDO. We need a number of Indian industries that can do it. And one way to do that is to say, we will buy these number of launches. We will help you build them. We will give you the money for doing it. And we are prepared to take a number of these. We are prepared to buy a number of these. And make sure that you pump in a lot of government-oriented money along with the industry money. Obviously, you don't do it only your way. And make sure that we actually create a few bigger companies who can do a lot of these operations. And of course, the small and medium sector in terms of applications and all that are huge, and we must promote them. We must make, you know, data available easily. It should be, you know, relatively easy to use. Communication satellites should be not only built by private sector, but also, you know, used by the private sector. We should make it easy, available. We should give all the relevant technology facilities, if necessary, even buy some of those satellites. So I think the government should not only be a promoter by changing the rules of the game, it should be an active buyer, right? I think when Professor Dhawan left ISRO, we were pretty much doing it. I think 70% of the ISRO money went to industry at that time. I think since that time, we have used industry mainly to provide subsystems and all that. We need to move industry into a process by means of which they become an active partner in promoting both the building of satellites and rockets and even launching them. We need to create more, I don't know, Virgin Galactics or Elon Musk or whatever it is.
Okay. Sir, if I may extend the same line of thought, and I would like ask two follow-up questions with link to that. First thing would be, you have mentioned about Elon Musk and having his launches covers the major chunk of the US satellite capabilities. So is there any opportunity or any paper that mentions that Elon Musk satellite are being used by U.S. military for its own purpose, especially in terms of reconnaissance or, say, for SIR?
I think it's very well known that the U.S. buys, okay, not only communications capacity. There used to be a satellite called Viacom, okay? It was a private company that had put up the satellite. And I think the satellite had more capacity than the DoD complete communication satellite network, okay? The U.S. buys. Okay, remote sensing, for example, all the data that they need, they buy. They also have a few select satellites. So increasingly, a lot, and you know, let's not forget, NASA is actually asking Elon Musk for its colonization of the of Mars, right? So my point is the US is certainly far ahead than anybody else in doing that. Okay, the Chinese are not bad. They have a number of entities. All of them are government controlled. They are companies under the government fold, but they have multiple suppliers of rockets, multiple suppliers of satellites. Their university, not the university system, the Academy of Sciences in China is pretty powerful. They can build their own satellites. Number of small companies are now putting satellites into orbit with their own launchers. So the Chinese are trying to mimic the American example. Okay. And the Chinese actively promote private companies. They actually provide the funding also. Now, we have created an environment by means of which we allow, with great reluctance, we allow them to participate. But I think we should promote them. Right? We should actually help them significantly more to make sure they build that capability. See, because space is a risky business. Apart from the technical risk, there's also political risk. Okay, political risk is if you have a remote sensing satellite data supplier and tomorrow there's a problem, they might put you in jail. Right? We also need some legal frameworks by means of which, you know, people are not penalized unnecessarily for no fault of theirs. Right? So there are lots of complications that are coming from the fact that we are not clearly articulated a role by means of which this critical domain is protected in the Indian interest, not necessarily in the ISRO interest or even in the military interest, but in the Indian interest, which is also economic, right? Which is also
economic. Thank you, sir. Then the next question is from K.K. Venkataraman. He has two-part question. The first is, that are any input available on the C4ISR network is integrated with weapons? Second, can you please throw a light on China's anti-satellite capabilities?
See, when you put a constellation like...
Professor?
A satellite-to-satellite network you have to first establish. It's difficult to establish, complicated technology, but it goes back a long time to Iridium. So it's all there. Okay, it can be done. It's being done. So obviously, without a network capability, you cannot even create such a constellation. Okay, for that matter, any constellation, whether it's an imaging constellation or an alien constellation, you need to make sure that you have in place a functioning network, right? The second part of the network is related to the use of that network, right? On the ground, users. Obviously, all of them are doing well, okay? So I would argue that they have established it, and many of them are actually making money on it, including, I'm sure Starlink has got major plans to commercialize. They made it available to Ukraine, you know, for the war effort. I think Elon Musk does not generally make major policy statements without being reasonably sure he can deliver on that. Okay. So I would think that all of it is in place, and therefore there is no question, right? A network and how it has to be used is going to be part of the architecture of planning itself before you do the hardware part and the establishment.
And sir, second question is that, can you please throw a light on China's anti-satellite capabilities?
According to me, they can do kinetic kill without any problem, as they have demonstrated. Okay. Now, they can go ASAT all the way up to geostationary orbit. That also they have demonstrated. Okay. So the kinetic kill capability is operational, one would argue, or potentially operational at a very short interval. So one capability is clear. Now, that capability is also there in many other countries. So the US has had it for a long time. Russia has had it for a long time. India has also demonstrated that it has it. So that's one part. On the laser dazzling and the jamming, I think jamming, everybody has the necessary thing. I would argue, I wouldn't know enough about the technical details of how the jamming is done. I am not a communications engineer, but my argument would be that a lot of people can do that. A lot of things can be done. As far as laser dazzling is concerned, I think with reasonably powered lasers, it is possible to dazzle some of the sensors that take pictures, or some sensors that look at the horizon or control the attitude of the satellite. I remember writing a paper when I was in ISRO about some of those kinds of things. That's a long time ago. There has been significant progress. So to kind of temporarily damage a satellite is also possible. To burn a hole through the satellite and then to drill a hole through a missile that is taking off, that Americans tried some experiments with a huge Boeing 747 and it was not very successful. So you can't generally use high-powered lasers to drill a hole or something like that. Okay. So my point is that part I don't know, but most of the other things, simple things are doable today. And I'm sure a lot of them are already being exercised. So I would argue the Chinese are also capable of doing most of these. Yeah.
Thank you, sir. Next question is from Professor Rapai. He asked that, what is your assessment about China's small and low orbit satellite?
I think it is a fantastic capability. Right? There's only one other country that can beat them, and that is America, which has an even more fantastic capability. The Chinese are pretty good. I mean, next to the US, they are not as good as yet as the United States, but they are definitely above any other country.
Sir, thank you. Next question is from Sugandha Tandon. She is an RA with ICS. So, you know, she mentioned that Bill Nelson has made a numerous statement about the space race in the media. Isn't it too far-fetched to draw a parallel between China's territorial claims in the South China Sea with China's potential claim in the outer space, despite China being a signatory to outer space treaty?
So let me come back. Territorial claims on the surface of the earth are fairly straightforward. I mean, we have some laws, we have some things in place, and therefore there are, you know, there are problems. I'm not trying to say there are no problems. There's something like the law of the sea. Some people abide by it, some people don't. There's also this territorial sovereignty, there's this EEZ. And there is some common practice associated with what is called commons, the global commons, okay? So the atmosphere, for example, or the oceans, for example, these are common areas, right? And therefore, there are some frameworks in place, okay? Now, as far as outer space is concerned, there is, I mean, my view of it is there are predominantly two views, right? Now, there is a treaty, for example, called the Moon Treaty, which looks at some, there are some statements in the treaty about how the resources of the moon are to be used, for example, right? There are differences of interpretation. If you want to get a treaty in the world of that day, you have to make sure that the definitions and the interpretations are very ambiguous, okay? So nobody is very clear whether exploitation of the resources of the moon, by whom is it legitimate, by whom is it not allowed? These things are not very clear. Now the US wants to do something like saying, if we go to the moon and we want those resources on the surface of the moon, we should have the right to do what we want with it, okay? Now the other question of the argument is, the moon is something that belongs not only to the US, it belongs to the whole world. And therefore it's something like a common, it's like something like a common property that is owned by all the countries of the world. And therefore anything that you do on the moon or in any other planet or in an asteroid has to be with the consent of all the involved parties. And therefore we must agree on how a governance framework to regulate this has to happen. Unfortunately, as I see it, I think the US view, right, is the dominant view. And in a world where only power matters, if the US decides to go ahead and exploit it, or if the Chinese decide to go and do what they want to do, there is very little the world can do to stop it. So the rules are always framed and the laws are always framed by the power elites and the relative power groupings within the power elite. And today, clearly, the US is pushing the exploitation, right, of both the moon, the planets, and the asteroids. Okay. So if you look at Elon Musk's statement, he talks of colonization. The word colonization, in my opinion, refers to the exploitation of the Western countries of all the rest of the world after the Middle Ages, coming well into the 20th century. So colonization and the attendant rights over the reserves of these unexploited areas, and the desire to do what they want with them. So clearly the moon belongs to all of us, right? I mean, I don't want the light of the moon not being visible to me. I mean, it's like that. But the way things are going, it looks like that will prevail, okay? And one can see clearly those are the dividing lines of the argument that are going forward. So it's all about power relationships. And therefore, one thing for India is obviously we have to be there somewhere if you want to be able to have at least a say in how these things will play out, if they play out. Right now, it looks like there are going to be two different views, and it's going to be very difficult to accommodate them. So the Americans want to set a precedent saying that we will do what it takes and that president will then dictate how the rules of the road will be framed in the future.
Sir, if I may extend your line of thought on that same context, sir, then I would ask you to give a light on if the same two domain of thought remains in this outer space too, and given the present capabilities of India in terms of space, what do you think India should look or do in terms of keeping that and have a say on the board, if that at all comes to a place?
See, my point is we have to worry about priorities, okay? So if I look at, this is the thing when we started the space program with Professor Dhawan also, what are India's priorities? Now, my argument is India's priority is very clear, right? We need to worry about the bulk of our people who are not, who need to be brought up in terms of economic requirements. So the first obvious requirement, right, according to me, must be to make sure that whatever we invest in the space program does give back something in terms of its benefits to a lot of Indians. Okay, so economic development, in my opinion, should be the first priority. The second part, as I see it, when I look at all the developments that are going on, right, I tend to believe that we have to be able to protect ourselves, especially against China. Okay, I am particularly concerned about China and the way they are going about what they are doing in the world. And if you have to do that, we have to make sure that in the military aspect of space, we are able to protect ourselves independently, right? We could tie ourselves with the US, but we then have to pay the price for doing that. So one would argue that the second priority, therefore, has to be military. If you want to achieve all of this, my third priority or the most important priority, we must involve Indian industry in a big way. They have to be active partners with support from the government, active support from the government in terms of money and reduction of risk, right, which they face. Therefore, we need to bring that component into the mix. So this should be my strategy. I would argue that the planetary exploration program and all that, we have to continue. We have to continue on that. But those are not clearly priority. Although it makes news and it makes, very nice hearing about all this. My point is, if you look at it from the viewpoint of a normal Indian like me, I would argue that this would represent what I think are the critical things that we face.
Oh, thank you, sir. Sir, next question is from Umesh Gupta. He mentioned that how far the Chinese language is posing a hurdle in understanding China's space program. Are we building language capabilities in this direction?
I have to confess that all the stuff that I have got about China, I have no idea of the Chinese language. Okay, I know a few words. I've looked at a few reference manuals on nuclear weapons and space and all that, just to make sure that I understand a little bit about the Chinese thing. Most of the stuff that I have written about is compiled only from Western sources or published sources, okay, which is largely Western. I would argue that, yeah, there is a need, but let me come back. The literature on space is very specialized, okay? It's not about learning Chinese from a political perspective or learning Chinese. So you need to have a lot of knowledge, okay? And if you look at a typical, equivalent dictionary, you need to master quite a lot of. So if you look at nuclear, it's very different from space, so you need to know a lot more. That said, I would agree that we need to invest a lot more in being able to translate originally. So I will say that, yeah, it's important. But should we wait for all this before we want to look at what China is doing, or should we go ahead and do that in parallel? I would argue we should look at the parallel option and use whatever we have and try and build a knowledge base around what is available, but also try to build on it with relevant. I don't know whether anybody translates Chinese technical documents, right, related to space into English in India. I'm not aware. If I'm aware, I'd like to know.
Sir, the last question, and if I understand the abbreviation correctly, it's Wing Commander Nirmal. He mentioned that will the collaboration in space program with friendly countries be more beneficial than stand-alone approach?
So you saw the picture I presented, right? Right now, our capabilities for a kind of war conflict scenario in terms of space coverage even for a very simple function like ISR, is not there, right? So we do not have any choice but to collaborate in order to be able to make sure that we address our immediate problems, okay? So I would argue that the US is one and the other friendly countries are another source, and we must collaborate with them. But all these international collaborations also comes with it a certain kind of give and take, and very often you have to give more than take, okay? So there's also a political relationship. And therefore, one should argue that this relationship should not be one where somebody is dominant and you are not so strong. We should move towards a position where we are at least in a position where we can negotiate better. So I would suggest that India should be significantly independent. That should be the goal in space capabilities. And we should not critically depend on these things to any other country. We must be independent. So I grew up in an era where we felt we should be self-reliant. I still believe that self-reliance is the key to the India of the future. And therefore, unless we create Indian capability, especially in Indian industry, we will continue to be a weak country, okay? And I do not want India, I mean, the India I would like to do, I would want India to be a powerful country, not necessarily in terms of waging war and winning wars, but powerful in the sense that, you know, we do all the good things for the reason that we are Indian. And I mean, that's the dream with which we grew up, okay? I see a significant erosion in the technological capabilities in India. I think we do not have enough people with technical knowledge in positions of power who understand the implications of building high-tech organizations, high-tech endeavors, and high-tech capabilities. We need a significant enhancement of the technological capabilities of the country. We have a lot of political decision makers. We have very good economists. We have great financial guys. But I think the technology part, which has driven the world and changed the world, I mean, there was no Facebook or there was no Amazon or there was no Apple 20 years ago. There was no Google 20 years ago, right? So we are, you know, we need to be there. And I think the technology route is one of the most underfunded, politically mismanaged group. That's my view.
Shantip, I think there is a question by Rapai.
Yes, sir.
Rapai, please go ahead. Yeah, Rapai.
Yeah, sir. Just a comment on what Mr. Chandrasekhar said. Thanks, Chandrasekhar, for your brilliant presentation. And this is a supplement to what you talked about the Chinese language capabilities. I remember long back, we had a program under INSDOC for technical translation and specializing people on that. But now I don't know where it is and what funding it is available. And I agree with you, Chinese space, not only space, each scientific branches need specialized vocabulary and specialized people to understand the Chinese data. Because I have seen their papers, they report daily on the basis, whatever the developments take place around the world, especially in US space technology and Russian space technology. So I don't think as of now, apart from government, nobody can even think of funding such a program. But government have many other priorities, so I won't get into that. But we need a dedicated group. If at all, we have to catch up with what they are doing in the space in Chinese language. Thanks.
Thank you, Rupai.
I agree completely with you. I don't have any issues. We need to do that. Yeah.
Sir, if you may, then I have one or two questions. Sir, may I?
Yeah, please.
Thank you, sir. Sir, the chair has mentioned about the satellites being hacked and all. So if I am correct, the quantum satellites have the capability to re-engineer itself and prevent it from hacking. So where does China stand in terms of the quantum satellite capacity? My second question is, you have mentioned that China is giving a strong head with the US in terms of the satellite capacity. So the China is also having a hold of over its critical mineral supply chain. So that capabilities, how far do you associate with the China's capacity of the satellite? And the last question is that India's military reconnaissance capacity. As we know, the Rukmini has overrun its life that has been mentioned, at least that is on record. So what do you think of India's military reconnaissance capacity and where that India stand?
Okay. Your first question was a quantum satellite, right?
Let me
clarify what the Chinese quantum satellite experiment was about. The Chinese quantum satellite is only to show, right, that a quantum key, right, can be successfully transmitted over a long distance. A quantum key is quite different from doing a lot of things that you're talking about, quantum computing or quantum encryption, right? A quantum key is like a key you share, right? So you it's a key you share in order to be, so I don't know whether you're familiar with something called public key, private key kind of.
Yes, I understand.
It is something like that. And what the Chinese quantum satellite did was, for the first time, it enabled a photon entangled transmission of a signal, right? From a space thing to a ground station and between two ground stations. I think the distance at that time was about 400 kilometers on the ground. Nobody knows whether the Chinese experiment, I have not followed up. Okay, so this is only what I read at the time I wrote the book. Okay, so I have not followed up. But the point is, the Chinese capability is only about the transmission of the key and whether the key came without any kind of problem. Okay, nobody knows whether how good it is. They did collaborate with Switzerland in terms of what they did, because Switzerland was considered to be one of the world leaders in this kind of thing. I have not looked at the scientific results of this. You must want to look at it to find out whether it's successful or not. But quantum key communication, in other words, the signal itself can be sent over very short distances, okay? And you need lasers to send the signal. It's not like a communication signal. You need laser to be able to do that. Now, while laser communication is becoming more often, and satellite to satellite links with lasers and all are ongoing, I think a couple of European satellites also have laser communication. So that's a new way to look at communication. So that's going to happen. So the problem is, the quantum computing in space is still not there. I think they're trying to build quantum computers on the Earth first. Okay, don't know the current status, but a lot of people are working on it, and therefore they are talking about some progress. Okay, but I think more than that, you need to talk to a more knowledgeable person than me. I just have a broad idea of what's going on. Yeah.
And sir, my second question was regarding the China's capability and giving a strong race to US. Does that is associated with China's strong hold on the supply chain of critical minerals?
Okay, so when you're looking at a negotiating position between two countries, right? And let's take a simple case. You know, take the Taiwan-North Korea link, right? In the negotiations between the... So why do you think the Chinese are always supporting North Korea, directly or indirectly? Because they see in it a kind of response to the fact that the US is always supporting Taiwan. Both are neighbors, right? And both are affected. So any kind of larger political negotiation, right, requires these elements of what are called carrots and sticks in order to achieve some kind of a consensus, okay? So China, we have done a lot of work on Chinese control of critical materials. We have a lot of reports, for example, we have generated on rare earths, for example. China controls about 90% of the global rare earth market. Now it may be about 80%, right? 75 to 80% of the global RE market. Any RE material that is mined anywhere in the world has to go to China for reprocessing and conversion into the appropriate parts for it to be made into value-added products downstream, okay? And the Chinese strategy for that has been worked out over a 25, 30-year period. So we have a string of 3 or 4 reports which details how the Chinese established this monopoly position. The one thing you can see similar in space is they have a very clear view on space also. It goes back to about 1990s, where they decided that they would focus attention once more on space, which they saw as a new emerging kind of domain of knowledge that they need to dominate. Okay. So whatever we have done a number of, so we also looked at single crystal blade technology, for example, that's used for aircraft engines. Once again, see, in all these cases, if you look at it, China has a very clear strategic plan, okay? And they are looking always to dominate the world. They are not looking at dominating local market and all that. It may be a part of it, but it's always about dominating the world. So they have identified rare earths as a critical resource long back. Today, they might also be looking at lithium. I think they have some major presence in lithium. I don't know about other things. Cobalt, I think, is largely Africa, but maybe they have a control of the mines in Africa also. One doesn't know. One has to do more detailed study. So they are, in my opinion, yeah, they will use their control over critical supply, raw material supply chains to try and leverage. I don't know whether you know that in response to an accident on the East China Sea between a Japanese trawler and a Chinese vessel, right? The Chinese cut off rare earth supplies to the Japanese, right? The Japanese industry could have collapsed, okay? Because they had only about 3 or 4 months of stock, right? I mean, so this kind of thing will happen, and one would expect it to happen. So this comes back to the other part, right? If you look at what the US is doing in response to this, it's building up its own supply chains, okay? For example, in rare earths, it has set up a number of facilities, not only to build, refine these material and to make products out of them. It's also gone into rare earth recycling, especially from electric vehicles, where magnets are used in large numbers. So they are putting up a big plant, huge plants with government support and government funding. And I would argue that over the next 10 years or so, they're going to move a little bit, at least a bit, but the Chinese will still control a significant part of these. And countries like Japan and all may be a little bit more vulnerable. They don't have the resources of the US. So yeah, these games will go on, but this is a larger game in which the military part and the strategic part is linked to the economic part. So it's a larger national kind of game that you are playing, right? So it's not only a military game, it's a bigger game. So economic part, right? Knowledge power, I go back to that power diagram I gave you, right? And space will be one part, but economic part is also a very, very important part of that larger power game.
Thank you, sir. With this, we have reached to the end of the session. Lieutenant General Bajwa, sir, would you like to give any concluding remark?
Sure. Thank you very much. I'll just add a couple of points. You know, it's very interesting that the navigation satellite system of the Chinese Bidoin 2 has been fully operational from 2020. And I'm actually wondering, are there your missiles and aircraft and everything going to be based on this? Till now, what were they doing? But if that is it, we got to do we know about the accuracy of this navigation system of theirs? And they are going to also extend this to the neighboring countries and those countries which have joined the Chinese and the BRI. And this is they call this the Space Silk Route or the Space Silk Road. And they're going to tie down these countries permanently with the Chinese, and just like their BRI loans, these countries are going to start suffering later in life. Well, I would thank Professor Chandrasekhar for his comprehensive presentation and a very interesting session of question and answers, which he dealt with so deftly and so well. I appreciate and can gauge his knowledge in the subjects. And thank you very much for that. And thank you also, Samandeep Mandal and Alka, for having organized this session. And we conclude with a great Jai Hind to everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, GP, for chairing such an excellent session. And thank you, Professor Chandrasekhar. It was extremely enlightening. I must say that this is something on which I'm a complete sixes and sevens. So it was very informative and fascinating. And your frank views about what needs to be done, I think that's the most refreshing part. We need to really call a spade now and see what is the road ahead here. Because as in many other things, we shouldn't be losing the race just about in every critical area. Thank you very much. And thank you all.
So thank you so much for having me. And I hope I didn't make life very difficult for you. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
No, not at all. We're just glad we were able to get you finally. Thank you.
So no problem at all. It's a pleasure. And thank you so much for all the, nice comments that I heard. Yeah, so good. I hope you people do something more along the lines of what I said. Yeah. So there's a lot of work to be done.
Sure. And we will look to you for suggestions and maybe some guidance as to how do we take
care. Yeah, I am in what I call the declining part of my life. So I'm very good at making suggestions. So I will.
Exactly. That's when the best, the most radical ideas come out. So actually, that's what we would like, really. Thank you so much. We'll be in touch. Thank you.
So thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you. Thank you.